just a baby. Before I could speak, I would line up all my letter blocks alphabetically. Now it's my vocation and my passion to assign every decimal numbered shelf to every decimal numbered spine. I'm alive.
I hope that the theme song has tickled your fancy. This is the Library Show. Then you are listening to it on KCAW Raven Radio right here in Sitka, Alaska. And always lots of stuff going on at the library, so be certain you check their website and finding out what the most recent events are. It's wonderful to see it busy. And we talk about not only books, but sometimes we talk about to hopefully people will understand that oftentimes we talk about books that are not necessarily residing in our library, but our library has such a wonderful interlibrary loan system now, particularly since they've become a joint library catalog with many libraries in Alaska. All you have to do is go online and choose the one you want, and that triggers an interlibrary loan process. And I've been delighted because it's just enlarged virtually the collection that the library has to offer. So even if we talk about something that's not residing in Sitka Public Library, don't fret. And if it's not anywhere in Alaska, then be sure to go to the section where you can request a purchase, because they do honor it most of the time. So I have a guest in who I have had numerous times because she just always brings wonderful things, wonderful variety, including for different age groups, I guess I would say. So without further ado, this is Kit Melema. And I guess, shall we start out by just saying, what's in your book bag, Kit?
Oh, well, first I want to say thank you for inviting me back. I really am enjoying this.
So. Oh, good. Well, yeah. We always have a good time.
We do. So my book bag today has a couple of things that you had recommended to me, and I am so thrilled to talk about it.
Oh, good.
Or at least one item. The first one is The Coroner's Lunch by Colin Cotterill, and I know you've mentioned his books a few times. You told me about them, and I got started. It's a series of books about a coroner in post-war Laos in the mid-1970s.
Right.
But I was also intrigued not only by the books, but by the story behind the books, because Mr. Cotterill has had kind of an interesting life. He was born in London. He was trained as a teacher. And then he went on a world tour after he finished college and had just an amazing set of adventures. So he taught in Israel. He taught in Australia, in the United States, in Japan. Then he went to Thailand and taught there. And he also taught on the Burmese border. And I couldn't get any more detail out of that. But that was interesting. Then he developed a television-based English language teaching program for Thai TV.
Wow, this is all something I never knew about.
I was just amazed to read this. But while he was in Thailand, he was struck by the problem of child poverty and the need for child protection. So, and not just in Thailand, but around Southeast Asia. So over the next few years, he set up a couple of NGOs to combat child trafficking and pornography, and he also helped train caregivers for the children who were rescued. And during that time, he'd been a writer. He'd written for a couple of Thai newspapers, and he expanded a little bit and began to write novels. And this series of novels that begins with The Coroner's Lunch is about Dr., and I know I'm going to not pronounce this correctly, and it was before the iPhone came out, but his name is Siri Paibun.
Okay.
He's a member of the Communist Party. He's a very reluctant recruit to the coroner's office, but he's the only person qualified in all of Laos.
Right.
And the first book starts with a body being wheeled in, and it's the wife of a high-ranking communist official. So, of course, he's on notice. He has to do a good job.
Right.
But he's hardly trained for it. He is a physician, but he's just barely trained to be a coroner. And his assistant is a nurse who also is not trained in forensics. And, man, I never really did figure out his age, but he has Down syndrome. And so he helps with some of the more menial tasks. But it's amazing the wisdom that comes
right.
out of his
yes.
mouth. So the coroner's lunch title comes from the fact that several times a week, Dr. Paibun meets with another communist official, and they get a lunch that is a sandwich on a baguette, mm-hmm. and they sit in a park, and they talk philosophy and politics and crime solving.
Well, and I think they were sort of, they're kind of older gentlemen.
They are.
And they have a very pragmatic, pragmatic things to say about the Communist Party.
Yes.
They're not sort of diehard. They're just sort of, okay, here we are.
Here we are. We're going to go with the flow right. and do what they tell us to do. The interesting thing about the stories, though, is that it's not only the here and now. There's a little bit of the spirit world blended in with it. Because he has dreams, Dr. Paibun has dreams and he has visions. And he goes places where the spirits are very active. So that colors his life and how he does his work.
Mm-hmm.
He also angers a few people with his honesty and his pragmatism. So sometimes he's in danger. And there's a little bit of... You get a little worried at times about what's going to happen with him.
Yes.
So this was the first of, I think, six books,
I think
maybe?
They're about six. I think I was just listening, and I cannot give you the title of the sixth one, but I did that as an audio book.
Oh, The Merry Misogynist.
Yes, that's
yes.
what it was.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I've actually read another three books in this series. You got me hooked, Sarah. Sorry.
Well, they're very fun. And my understanding is that Colin Cotterill has written a series now that takes place in Thailand.
Yes.
So
yes.
I haven't touched those.
I haven't either, but I've been watching to see if he's adding anything to them. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good report.
Yeah.
So isn't that nice that by listening to the library show, you find out new titles to read?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's go to the next one.
So my next one is called Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye. This is not fiction. This is written by Marie Mutsuki Mockett, who was born and raised in California with a Japanese mother and an American father. And I think her mother was an opera singer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But she traveled frequently to Japan with her mother. So even as a child, she understood some of the customs of Japan and could speak the language and understand what people were saying to her. Eventually, though, as an adult, she felt pulled to go back. Her family owned a 350-year-old Buddhist temple in the Tohoku prefecture, and that was the area that was hit when the tsunami and earthquake occurred.
Okay.
And they were actually affected also by the radiation from the Fukushima power plant.
Right.
So that kind of coincided with the death of a couple of family members. And Marie was having difficulty reconciling her Japanese-American history or heritage with what was going on in Japan and with the deaths of her family members. So she spent an extended period of time both in the earthquake region, watching how the people were recovering from it and who was helping with the recovery, and was very surprised to see that it was several Buddhist monks who were coming in and or priests who were coming in to aid in the recovery. But she also used it as a time to expand her own spiritual growth and learn more about meditation. So she visited several temples and practiced under some masters. And then to add to it and really to come to grips with what was going on with her family, she also visited a couple of places that were associated with death and the spirit world. And that's where the title comes in, where the dead pause and the Japanese say goodbye, because she visited a river in, I believe, in the Tohoku area, where legend has it that people, spirits, were seen as they went from this world to the next. And there was this pause as they traveled the river to go on to the next world. And sometimes people came there to say goodbye to their loved ones. And that's what she came to do. And it's very moving, the story of how she reconciled her double heritage,
right,
there, and came to grips with both what was happening in the country and what had happened in her personal life.
Had she written things before, or was she just inspired to write because of this?
She had written quite a bit before, mostly magazine articles.
Okay.
She has done a novel. The name of the novel is Picking Bones from Ash, that has to do with a Japanese girl who becomes an accomplished pianist, travels the world, has a daughter from whom she becomes estranged, and eventually meets back up with her daughter. But in the meantime, her daughter has become involved in a Japanese antique, not quite black market,
no,
but a little situation.
Questionable,
yeah, yeah. So, and her daughter, I think, is in her 20s at the time.
Okay.
So that's an interesting novel to pick up, and I would recommend it.
Okay.
So, yeah. But the whole idea of going back to visit your family in a 350-year-old Buddhist temple,
yes,
and watching how they interact with the people around them, and watching how they go through the process of grieving for those missing family members, was really intriguing. And that was well written. She really obviously put a lot of work into it.
Sounds like a good read.
Yeah, and I think they actually made a television show out of it for NHK, the Japanese
television station. Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, do you have a little passage that you wanted to read from something?
From another book?
Okay. Well, yeah, let's get to that book then.
Yeah. So something I mentioned to you was that these authors are people who are kind of out of place,
right,
in a different place.
Right.
Right. So the next book is called The Buried Giant by Kazuo Ishiguro. He's a British author, and people who
recognize Japanese heritage.
Very Japanese heritage, yeah. He wrote The Remains of the Day and Never Let Me Go, because he was born in Nagasaki, but when he was 5, his parents moved to London. They were scientists, and he's been in England ever since. And just kind of as a little aside, he also writes jazz music.
Yeah.
So, but The Buried Giant it had mixed reviews. I loved it. And it's set in post-Arthurian Britain. There's kind of a tentative peace between the Saxons and the Britons, but still a lot of uneasiness between them. And I think if anybody gave them half a chance, they'd go back to war.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important thing is that people have trouble remembering things, or they remember things not as they happened, but as they wanted them to happen. There's this mist that covers the land, and everything is just kind of fuzzy and vague.
Mm-hmm.
And the two main characters are an older couple named Axel and Beatrice, who live in the margins of a community that are hillside dwellers. They've kind of been cast out a little bit from their group. And Beatrice, all of a sudden, decides that she wants to go visit their son, who moved away. And she thinks that he's famous and well-respected in another community. And so she convinces Axel that that's what they need to do. And the book is a series of the adventures that they have as they go on this journey together. A lot of it is very vague, because of the remembering problem and the mist that covers.
Yes, it sounds like that pervades.
Yeah, you can almost see it running through the novel or running through the pages. But along the way, they meet some soldiers who are on patrol. They spend a night in a Saxon village. They go looking for a dragon. They meet Sir Gawain, with whom Axel has had a previous relationship, but he can't remember what the relationship was, and neither can Gawain. So that's the connection to Arthur. And they find themselves in a monastery where some very strange things happen. Throughout the book, though, you get this sense that things are happening in slow motion, and it's hard to get a grasp of time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to tell the end of the story.
Yes. Well, it sounds like a really interesting way of exploring, not exactly fantasy, because Arthur has some sense of history, in kind of an unusual way through those two characters.
Yes. Yeah. But it's also about our memories. And about how we deal with memories, what we remember, what we forget. Mm-hmm. It's about people at war and how they deal with that. And what about the war do they want to remember and what do they want to forget? Mm-hmm. So I had a couple of segments picked out to read from this. This is in the very beginning. This morning, Axel moved the barrier just enough to let himself in, taking care to make as little noise as possible. Here, the early dawn light was leaking into the room through the small chinks of their outer wall. He could see his hand dimly before him, and on the turf bed, Beatrice's form still sound asleep under the thick blankets. And just as an aside, they're not allowed to have a candle. They've been told that their candle it was taken away from them. And again, they're kind of on the margins. He was tempted to wake his wife, for a part of him felt sure that if at this moment she were awake and talking to him, whatever last barriers remained between him and his decision would finally crumble. But it was some time yet until the community roused itself and the day's work began. So he settled himself on the low stool in the corner of the chamber, his wife's cloak still thick around him. Are still tight around him. He wondered how thick the mist would be that morning, and if, as the dark faded, he would see it had seeped through the cracks right into their chamber. But then his thoughts drifted away from such matters back to what had been preoccupying him. Had they always lived like this, just the two of them, at the periphery of the community? Or had things once been quite different? Earlier, outside, some fragments of a remembrance had come back to him. A small moment when he was walking down the long central corridor of the Warren, his arm around one of his own children, his gait a little crouched, not on account of age as it might be now, but simply because he wished to avoid hitting his head in the beams in the murky light. Possibly the child had just been speaking to him, saying something amusing, and they were both of them laughing. But now, as earlier outside, nothing would quite settle in his mind. And the more he concentrated, the fainter the fragments seemed to grow. Perhaps these were just an elderly fool's imaginings. Perhaps that it was that God had never given them children. You may wonder why Axel did not turn to his fellow villagers for assistance in recalling the past. But this was not as easy as you might suppose, for in this community the past was rarely discussed. I do not mean that it was taboo. I mean that it had somehow faded into a mist as dense as that which hung over the Martians. The marshes. It simply did not occur to these villagers to think about the past, even the recent one.
Oh, it is. Boy, the fog is not only real, it's metaphorical, isn't
it? Yes, it is. It is.
Oh, that sounds like a good one.
And as you... As the story goes on, you get more and more of their relationship as they emerge from the fog, and it begins to gel.
To come together and make a little
So it's a little sense. It's a little romantic in a way.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah. And to me, it's always so interesting because Kazuo Ishiguro has certainly imbibed the culture that he grew up in.
Absolutely.
Rather than the one he was maybe born into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his mother, he grew up with his mother reading him stories of Japanese heroes, but it was England that really shaped and formed his career.
Well, can I break in?
Absolutely.
And I brought a little book bag. Oh. But this one I wanted to mention because it's called The 70-Mile Kid, The Lost Legacy of Harry Carstens and the First Ascent of Mount McKinley by Tom Walker. And I wanted to talk about it because it was a former participant on the library show. I saw him dashing into the library and what are you reading? And he said, well, I'm kind of in a hurry. I'm going back up north. What's the name of the community right by Mount McKinley where they all, it'll come to me, but where the climbers all depart from. And so he said, well, I read this great book. And I said, oh, can I read it? And he said, do you promise to donate it to the library when you're done with it? Because that's what he had planned to do. And it's quite an incredible story. And it took place in 1913. And there were several groups that had tried to climb Mount McKinley, but they just didn't quite make it. One pair got very close. But when you think about, you can see this picture, what kind of gear they have.
It looks like he's wearing just a plain cotton coat.
It almost does. And Harry Carstens was quite a young man, and then he came initially for the gold rush, but ended up finding that he probably could make a more solid income by running freight with a dog team. And so he was all over Alaska and was quite, he was not a climber as such, but he was an incredible outdoorsman. So he was asked to join a man who was an Episcopalian minister, but in his 50s, to see if they could get to the top of Mount McKinley. And even though you sort of know what the outcome is going to be, it is really an amazing adventure story because of the fact that it never quite goes as planned, and there really wasn't an established route.
No, not at that time.
Not at that time. No. So they had to just sort of, based on what had gone before them, and there were actually, I can't remember the names, Cook, I think, not the Cook, but had said that he had made it to the top. Well, in fact, he had not made it to the top and was a bit misleading for a few groups that followed in his footsteps. So, and the interesting, Talkeetna, that's where was going. And, well, big jumping off spot for going up the mountain. But it's a good read and full of adventure. And the exciting thing is he has talked the librarian into Talkeetna to doing their own library show.
Oh, what fun.
So, yeah, so it's kind of spreading.
Yeah, what a
so,
great idea.
It's a great adventure story. It's very well written. I'm not going to take any time to read from it. I'd selected a passage, but not necessary. So I would encourage people to pick up The 70-Mile Kid, The Lost Legacy of Harry Carstens, and The First Ascent of Mount McKinley by Tom Walker.
So, what fun.
Yeah, I think it would be a good adventure. And I think this is the 100th or the 150th anniversary of the national parks. So, and Denali is one. So people maybe in celebration could read that book.
What a great idea.
All right.
Yeah.
So I know you have a couple of more things in your book bag.
I do. Well, I always love to talk about children's books. And one day, not too long ago, my granddaughter and I were watching a spider laying an egg sack.
Oh.
And I said, oh my goodness, we need to get Charlotte's Web.
That's right.
So I'm not going to go too much into it except to say that for the younger group and the older group, this is a wonderful, warm-hearted story about some pig.
Right, some
and
pig.
And some pig. And a wonderful mentor he had in Charlotte the Spider.
It's a great read aloud.
It is. It is. It's. I think E.B. White wrote it to be read aloud. He wrote several children's books, mostly on behalf of his niece. And I think he did it to be read aloud.
And I think what he also wrote, Stuart Little.
There were a couple of others on the list of things that he wrote. And the interesting thing was he was born and raised in New York. He wrote for the New Yorker. That was his. So he's a little out of place with the children's books, except he's known better for the children's books. His wife, Catherine White, was the she was one of the editors for the New Yorker. I can't remember which one she had, which department she had charge of. But we also know him as the co-author of Strunk and White, The Elements of Style.
Oh, boy, so, I didn't put the White and attach that to E.B. White. So many of us grew up with that in hand during high school and college.
I still have a copy of it.
And I think that people still hold it in high regard.
Yes.
So if you want, and I keep sort of trying to preach that people need to read to and with their children because we are told that it's so important that little children hear language. Well, sometimes it's hard to carry on a conversation, especially with the pre-language infant or child, but because you sort of run out of things to say. But if you pick up a book and read that, that supplies you with all kinds of language and all kinds of things to talk about.
It opens up great opportunities. Now, my granddaughter will be 8 next month, and she loves to be read to. My grandson is 13. He loves it when we read to him still. You know, he likes to. He'll be doing something else, and we'll be reading. And he loves it.
He tunes in,
yeah.
Isn't that great? And I'm still listening to audiobooks, so apparently
there you go.
I think
once you start, you just never stop.
I think so, too. Well, tell us about this book that you have.
So this is a wonderful little book of poetry that I keep in my purse all the time, so I can always open it up and read it. It's called Telling the Bees. It's poems by Faith Sheeran. I first heard her on the Writer's Almanac one morning, listening to the radio. And she writes beautiful poetry that I think many of us can relate to.
Do you have one you can share?
Yeah.
She's sort of flipping through the book. Okay.
So this one's called My Grandparents' Generation. They are taking so many things with them. Their sewing machines and fine china. Their ability to fold a newspaper with one hand and swat a fly. They are taking their rotary telephones and fat televisions and knitting needles. Their cast iron frying pans and Tupperware. They are packing away the picnics and perambulators, the wagons and church socials. They are wrapped in lipstick and big band music, dressed in recipes. Buried with them, bathtubs with feet, front porches, dogs without leashes. These are the people who raised me, and now I am left behind in a world without paper letters, a place where the phone has grown as eager as a weed. I am going to miss their attics, their ordinary coffee, their chicken, fried in lard. I would give anything to be 10 again, up late with them, in that cottage by the river, buying Marvin Gardens and passing go, collecting $200.
Ooh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And so you've probably read all of the poems in that book.
I've read most of them.
And why do you like to carry around a book of poetry?
It's a nice break. It's, if I have a few minutes to wait for something, a book of poetry gives something short, usually, and something that often speaks directly to me. There's something about poetry that it just touches your soul that is you do that, you get that from a book, a novel, or even an autobiography or nonfiction. But this comes from the heart and it touches the heart.
Right. Well, it was lovely because all of those images, I went, aha, I know those.
I know those.
Well, let's just reiterate the titles that you've read today or talked about.
So we have The Coroner's Lunch by Colin Cotterill and several others he's written. Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye by Marie Mutsuki Mockett. The Buried Giant by Kazuo Ishiguro, Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, and Telling the Bees by Faith Sheeran.
Well, thank you very much, Kit Allgood-Melama. I hope you'll come to the library show again sometime.
Thank you, Sarah. I'd love to.
Okay, bye-bye.